Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this week we are going to be talking firstly about the House of Horrors that is the UK Ministry of Defence's housing stock, which is dilapidated, crumbling and not actually owned by the Ministry of Defence. That's coming up first. Then after that we're going to be taking a quick whistle stop tour over to Qatar, which is of course hosting the World Cup. We're going to be talking to the Eye's sporting hack, Sarah Shannon, all about the other countries involved in the World Cup, which you might not have been reading quite so much about so far, but which have been just as involved in their own way as Qatar themselves. But first, housing. One of the stories in the latest edition of Private Eye is about the UK Ministry of Defence's housing stock. There are roughly 50,000 homes, which are for both families and single members of the armed forces. And these homes, it turns out, have not been maintained perhaps quite as well as the people who have to live in them could have hoped for. The maintenance of these homes, the upkeep, is outsourced to a few different firms. The chief point of contact for troops and their families is a firm called Pinnacle. Service families contact Pinnacle to book repairs through their call centre, and after that, the physical repairs are carried out by two other firms called Amy and Vivo under separate contracts with the MOD and Defence Infrastructure Organisation. The contract was signed relatively recently, and already there are some worrying signs that, as has happened very frequently in the history of British military housing, neither the homes nor the residents are being looked after especially well. Jane McKenzie is the journalist who has recently taken up the baton of writing about UK military housing. I started off by asking her what people were hoping for when Pinnacle took over the contract not so many months ago.
So there were certainly high hopes from military families that they were going to see improvements. They've dealt with absolute horrors in terms of maintenance over decades now. Military families have had sort of the worst experience of having a bad landlord, effectively, who doesn't do the repairs, and you arrive on your first day to move in and you discover the carpets are manky and there are stains on the walls and the previous people's rubbish is still in the garden and all that kind of thing.
God.
Yes, there was a lot of hope that Pinnacle was going to immediately arrive and be better.
Yeah. It's a story about outsourcing, isn't it? Because Pinnacle are a private firm and they were given a contract, I think you mentioned in your article, I think it was a seven-year, £144 million contract to maintain the stock of military housing in the UK for troops and their families.
That's right. This is family housing. So okay. Sort of not the single people's kind of barrack housing. This is where people have the house, like, it, you know, that they can live in with their partners and their kids.
Some people think, oh, troops, anyone in the armed forces will be living in a barracks, and it's not the case at all.
Very large numbers of people are married, or yeah, they're raising families. They obviously have to live close to base or on base. Yeah. So there's quite a lot of housing that was built around the military bases in the UK as forces accommodation.
So Pinnacle have taken over. What's that, 7 months so far? What are the early signs about how it's going?
Well, not great. I mean, we're not suggesting that they're a brand new to housing company. They do other housing around the country. They shouldn't be having to learn on the job. They should have been able to come in and offer a good service from day one. People might have hoped that if they were to call Pinnacle and say, you know, the bathroom wall has fallen down, that they'd get maintenance and repair like anybody would hope from
your landlord.
Landlord, yeah. Yes.
And, you know, it's boilers and it's standard stuff. The housing is not very unusual.
It's not. It's actually very typical of quite poor UK housing stock mid-20th century through to the 1970s. So, unfortunately, yes, a lot of it's hard to heat. It hasn't got the ideal ventilation and all that kind of issues with that age of housing stock.
Okay. So you've got this stock of not very good housing. I think it's about 50,000 homes just under, which are falling under the Pinnacle umbrella now.
It is. They're not all full of people.
Okay.
There is, in fact, a proportion of them that aren't really good enough to take people at the moment. And also, as the armed forces personnel numbers have shrunk, there are numbers of empties around.
Okay.
Which should, in a way, make their job easier. They at least can deprioritise the ones that don't have people in them.
Yeah, but they've already apologised. Or rather, it hasn't been Pinnacle themselves who've apologised. It's the DIO, which is the Defence Infrastructure Organisation. So is that part of the MOD?
Part of the MOD.
And they're responsible for maintaining, not the houses, but the relationship with Pinnacle.
Yes, so they are the part of the MOD which is responsible for maintaining all of the buildings
infrastructure
around
right.
the country. So that whether that's the hangars the planes live in, or the houses that the pilots live in, or for the army, there's sort of various bases, both in the UK and abroad, that they are ultimately responsible for. A lot of that is contracted out to companies right. to do the facilities management or maintenance of the buildings themselves. But the DIO is the kind of the top body in that chain that's right. responsible for those contracts.
Solomon Hughes has also been writing about this story recently from a slightly different angle, the aspect of who actually owns Pinnacle itself. Here's Solomon explaining what gave him the idea to actually look into this.
I mean, I really just read Jane's story. It's sort of a bit crude in a way. I read The Private Eye and thought, that's an interesting story. And Jane had said this before to you know, this story was coming, and it sort of somehow went over my head. And then I read it and thought, oh my God, she's written a really important story here. And so I just did the really basic double check of looking at the company's house to look at ownership. And it turned out that somewhere between 25 and 50% of the firm was owned by, or has under significant control or ownership is the phrase, but you know, is controlled or owned by a guy called Chi Hua Terence Tsang, who's a Chinese national living in Hong Kong. And I just thought, well, that's odd. Where did he come in? And I entered into a long conversation with the company, saying, well, you know, well, who is he, and why is a Chinese national resident in Hong Kong owns, you know, a substantial proportion of a firm that's looking after British military housing. I mean, from two points of view. One is I just have a general idea that when public assets are owned yeah. or managed by people who don't live in Britain, I'm not saying this from a super nationalist point of view, but somebody who's a long way away isn't going to care that much about it. The thing that travels long distances is money. You know, so I'm just thinking, when you have these questions of public services are owned or managed by foreign investors, it's like, you know, they've just found an easy way to siphon money out of, in this case, you know, one of the very oldest parts of the British state. Also, relations with China go up and down, but I mean, he's actually, they're not an ally. The management of our army housing is partly owned by somebody who lives in a nation which is at least a rival, you know, according to latest political talk. Now, I looked up Terence Tsang. I mean, he's, you know, he's individually very wealthy. He's a guy who's around the kind of, you know, the kind of Hong Kong billionaire property circuits.
So are you saying, sorry, he's not a member of that family?
He's not a member of the family. He's often associated with them. He often has jobs where he's their representative. I mean, in this case, he isn't. But I'm just trying to say he's a guy from, if you like, kind of Hong Kong billionaire property circles. That's his kind of thing. And then the other second major investor, and I couldn't quite quantify how much, it's a lot, is a US billionaire called Barry Sternlicht, who doesn't invest a lot. I don't know, he does invest a lot. I think he typically invests in, you know, like shopping centres and things like that. But he's just a big American investor. And I just think, well, okay, so here's the company that's supposed to be partly managing British military housing, and they're doing a bad job.
And what a bad job they are doing. Here's Jane McKenzie.
An interesting indicator of the level of problems is that Pinnacle have now set up a specific mould hotline so that people whose houses are covered in black mould can get through to them more quickly because of the problems they were having getting a response.
And as part of this, because, I mean, I'm not saying the whole of it is, but is part of this because some of these houses have been unoccupied and not maintained well in the past? As in, if the houses have been maintained well and insulated and looked after from the point they were built, whenever in the 20th century that was, you wouldn't be having to have a mould hotline now. Is that part of it?
Yes. As with a lot of the sort of public housing stock around the country, whether that's council housing or sort of now privately owned or housing association or military buildings, those buildings do need ongoing care. Almost all buildings need ongoing care, but buildings that were built without adequate insulation had somebody retrofitted them and sorted those problems out and double glazed the windows but had good ventilation. Yes, you wouldn't have mould.
Okay, so this is where we get into the tangled history of housing stock for the military in the UK, because this story goes back to 1996 in particular, because these houses, although they're maintained by a private firm, they're also owned by a separate private firm.
Yes, so long before I was ever writing about this, my late colleague Squarebasher was covering the issues with Annington Homes, which own the housing stock under a PFI deal, which was a particularly bad one. Now, we've written a lot about bad PFI deals, but this was a particularly ridiculous one because it used to belong to the MOD. It was all sold to Annington at a terrible time in terms of predicting the rise of house prices and rents. So the MOD got out of being a property owner just at the wrong time. So it's now leasing back its what were its own buildings. The deal ludicrously included leasing back the empties.
So the MOD was paying rent for homes which were not occupied. Okay.
It was leasing back the entire estate, not just the bits it needed.
Right.
So it's been wasting money on leasing back.
Solomon Hughes.
So it's the 1990s, and at that point, celebrity train enthusiast and red trouser wearer Michael Portillo was actually a government minister, not a comic character on the television. And he had the incredible idea of saying, well, I'll sell all, I think it was about 50,000 then, I think maybe it's down to about 40,000, I'll sell 50,000 married quarters, army housing, to somebody and then rent it back. And that was his idea. And it was a fantastic idea in the sense of you think, is this some weird fantasy? And obviously everyone looked at it and said, that's mad. Why are you doing that, Michael? But he had lots of experts who said, no, it's in fact a very clever thing to do. And it's good to sell your house in order to rent it back. You know, who knew? It sort of was disturbing at the time. I mean, I can remember 1996, you know, even through the haze of Britpop-induced drinking. You know, it was shocking at the time because Nomura, the Japanese bank, you know, so the initial interest was from a foreign investor. Their man who was running it was Guy Hans. And Guy Hans was just very politically connected. He was good friends with William Hague. And so you just think this politically connected person has got a Japanese bank to buy all the military housing and then they're going to rent it back. That doesn't sound right. Because it wasn't. And so that happened. And then the deal was so bad. These are the two really bad elements of the deal. One was selling your house to rent it back is generally not recommended. Mm. And I just emphasise, I'm not, I don't think I'm authorised by the Financial Conduct Authority to offer financial advice to private podcast listeners. But I believe that selling your house to rent it back isn't advised. But that's what we did. But yeah. Then they had this extra bit where they said, yes, we'll sell all the houses to Nomura, as it then it was, but we'll rent it back, but we will do all the repairs. and this is where Pinnacle come in. So the Ministry of Defence said, yeah, we'll sell them, get a bit of money, rent it back, and then we'll have to spend all that money on repairing the houses we don't own, which is just crazy.
The MOD's managed to get such a poor deal out of the way it handled that particular PFI. It was criticised by the National Audit Office over it. And then on top of that, so it leases them back, but then hires another company to manage them.
Yeah.
So it, at that earlier, before the Pinnacle situation, it was hiring Carillion Ame to maintain them,
right,
who were criticised in repeated Defence Select Committee reports for how bad a job they were doing of maintaining them.
And Carillion were the outsourcing giant who fell apart several years ago. Is this why it was necessary to hire Pinnacle? Because Carillion were no longer on the scene?
Well, I think certainly they weren't an option for when the contract came round to to do again.
Yeah. And again, it's amazing. Looking back at the stories from, you know, the early 2000s onwards, writing about military housing and its deficiencies, it's just been going on and on and on, these failings.
Absolutely. And at the same time as the government are talking up, oh, there's a military covenant, these people are going out to fight in difficult places and maybe dying or being seriously injured, and their families have to deal with the consequences of that. So we ought to be housing them well, at the very least.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Looking back at, so the military covenant, as it gets called, that was something that David Cameron announced in 2010, and it basically ensured that all members of the armed forces would have the right to decent housing, and lots of other things as well, but that was a big part of it. And that was in an environment where the Eye had reported in early 2010, so before that election, that in Christmas 2009, there had been thousands of service personnel and their families who'd spent their Christmas in substitute accommodation, which is private, temporary, rented housing, kind of stopgap stuff. And it was nearly 7,000 homes that had been quickly and hastily rented as substitutes for homes they couldn't provide.
Yeah, and in more recent times, with the cladding saga that's been going on in other housing news, they're not exempt from that either. They managed to clad several high-rise buildings of forces accommodation up in Scotland with exactly the dangerous materials that are now causing problems for people living in high-rise buildings all around the country.
And so have those buildings had to be cleared out? Are they just still inhabited but unsafe?
I haven't checked recently what the situation is there. I think they were doing, having to have round-the-clock fire watch.
Right. Oh, OK, because that's an option when, you know, everything else has failed, basically. It's just constantly have someone looking for a fire and then...
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I guess that has it in common with the Houses of Parliament, doesn't it? Because they have to have a 24-hour fire watch at the moment, I believe. Yeah.
It's not a brilliantly safe place, certainly.
No.
For many reasons.
But I guess they can say at least we're providing our troops in Scotland with the same quality of housing.
Of safety.
Yeah, that our own MPs are getting. So that's a bit of good news. I already know the answer to this, but is there any prospect that either these homes or the maintenance of these homes is going to be taken back into public ownership, or that would help matters at all?
There is a legal row rumbling on between the MOD and Dannington. Regarding whether it's possible to take the entire Holmes estate back from them.
Are the MOD arguing that they would like
they
to
would
do
like
this?
To.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. And Dannington are digging their heels in and saying, correct. we don't want to sell and you can't make us.
Yes.
Oh, well, okay, watch this space in the magazine.
Watch this space, because the MOD does now recognise that it's not worked well.
Right. Although it sounds like knowing the MOD's luck in timing the market, they're going to buy everything back shortly before the biggest housing crash.
Exactly the wrong point in the market, yes.
So if you would like to buy 50,000 slightly dilapidated homes at what will probably shortly be a knockdown rate, just contact Private Eye and we will sort you out with our outsourcing team, who will outsource you to the Ministry of Defence. Thanks to Jane McKenzie and Solomon Hughes there. Now we turn to the World Cup, and Sarah Shannon has got her moles on the ground in Doha, who have been reporting back on exactly what the mood has been like in the opening days of the competition. Here's Sarah.
I'm hearing that the stadium's slightly lacking in atmosphere. They're mostly full. The spectator numbers are okay. They're sort of 80% full. But the atmosphere isn't great compared to a normal World Cup. And the way that the Qataris are overcoming this is that they're ratcheting up the PA system to the loudest level imaginable, so loud that you can't hear the person next to you speaking. And that's their way of kind of, you know, overcoming the lack of atmosphere and making it seem really exciting in the ground when perhaps it isn't.
So Russia hosted the last World Cup in Sochi, obviously, 4 years ago, and things have changed a great deal between Russia and the West since then.
Yes. I mean, it's strange to think that, you know, Russia had already invaded a part of Ukraine at that point and that was okay. But clearly it's not okay now. Russia's banned from international competition. However, things are still pretty cozy with FIFA. And the Emir of Qatar recently thanked Russia for all its help with organising, you know, giving tips on how to organise a great World Cup. And Putin said, no problem, we're here for you right till the end. So on some level of sort of autocratic leadership, there's quite friendly stuff still going on with Russia and its World Cup legacy.
And these World Cups were both awarded at the same time, weren't they, to Russia and Qatar?
Yeah, a double whammy back in 2010. Qatar and Russia won at the same time. So Qatar had this enormously long lead-in to prepare, which it really did need, because, you know, it's a Winter World Cup for the first time. Everyone had to reorganize their schedules, and they had to build 9 stadiums in the desert.
Goodness.
You know, there's other interesting regimes are obviously taking part. The Iranians played England last Monday. Of course, the Iranian players very bravely didn't sing their national anthem. I hear that when that game got shown in Iran, they didn't show that part of the match, which is almost really unheard of. You always show your teams in the national anthem. But anyway, Iran will still benefit from the World Cup, whatever happens to them, because they'll get $10.5 million from FIFA for getting to this point. In fact, if they get through into the next round, they would get even more money. So the Iranian government are quids in anyway.
And that's because the prize pool is bigger than it ever has been before, is that right?
That's right, yeah. FIFA have got an enormous amount of money to play with. This is the richest World Cup ever. Their profit on it is up $1 billion. I think it's $7.5 billion.
God, that's an enormous amount.
It is, yeah, but not as much as Qatar had to spend on building the stadiums and getting ready to host what might be seen as the biggest own goal in history.
So can you just explain the sort of structure of where the money's coming in and going out, where, you know, the Qatari government is spending a huge amount, obviously, FIFA are making an enormous profit, the broadcast rights are sold around the world.
So Qatar is spending £200 billion to host this World Cup. They've built their 9 stadiums. What hasn't been mentioned that much is that these are sort of modular stadiums that can be taken down after the World Cup, and they're going to be given to various African nations. That was a part of their original bid back in 2010, part of what made them appealing to FIFA, apart from any other appealing things they might have or might not have done to make themselves amenable to the FIFA leadership. And then, yeah, FIFA rakes in the money from marketing, sponsorship, and then television rights, of course, are a massive part of that. Oh, Qatar's also got to pay money to somebody to be its ambassador, David Beckham. He's been paid £150 million to be the ambassador. He says it's a great opportunity for progress and inclusivity and tolerance.
Hang on, Sarah, wasn't David Beckham one of the leading figures behind the English bid in 2010 to host the World
Exactly.
Cup, which we then lost to Qatar?
I know, but this is a great opportunity for progress, inclusivity and tolerance, Andy.
Oh, sorry.
He's £150 million for losing his reputation with the LGBT community forever. But that's a whole other matter. I hope it's worth it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that kind of explains the enormous amounts of money sloshing around behind the scenes. And as you were just saying, the money that will be going to all the nations participating, including Iran, for
yes.
example, and the sort of the massive prize pot
yes.
on display. I think you mentioned last time you wrote about this that FIFA were budgeting revenue for this year of $4.7 billion, and about half of that, just over half, is from broadcast rights. So that money will be going to the Iranian government, which is a... considering relations between Western governments and Iran, is a weird, I'm going to say, quirk
yes.
of this World Cup?
Yes, by some weird circuitous route, some of your BBC licence fee payer pounds may be going straight to the leadership in Tehran to help them put down some of those protests that are going on there now.
Oh, bloody hell. Okay, so we've covered Russia and Iran, and I think you've also been writing about Germany and the unusual connections that have been going on there, particularly
yes.
with stadium construction.
Well, the German team this week made that very memorable protest. They weren't allowed to wear the One Love armband by FIFA that was to represent diversity. It kind of morphed from a specific LGBTQ statement to something more general. It was a hint of a rainbow, really, but FIFA couldn't put up with that and banned it. And as a result, the German team was so angry about being silenced that they did this very memorable team photo with their hands cupped over their mouths to show that they'd been silenced. But yes, we pointed out in this week's issue that there's another connection with Germany that's less well known about, which is that the the master plan for the 9 Qatari stadiums that was put to FIFA back in 2010, and I think was even an important part of Qatar winning that bid, was actually drawn up by a firm of Frankfurt architects called Speer and Partners. And it was led by its founder architect, who's called Albert Speer. Albert Speer Jr., that is.
Albert Speer, familiar name, but yes. For any younger listeners, could you maybe...
Well, Albert Speer Sr. was known as Hitler's architect, Hitler's favourite architect. And he, amongst other things, designed the stadium in Nuremberg where all those Nazi rallies were held. And all these years later, his son is designing the stadiums for another very autocratic... Well, I suppose I shouldn't compare the Qataris with Nazi Germany. Perhaps that's unfair. but for another autocratic regime and another set of stadiums that turned out to be very controversial in their own way because of all the migrant workers that died during their construction. But yes, amazing that. Speer and Partners... Germany's unknown connection to the World Cup.
So having dealt with the Russians, the Iranians and the Germans, let's return to, in a way, to Britain, because there's a really interesting aspect of this World Cup, which is about gambling and the amount of money being spent in bets on the World Cup and also the sponsorship and whether gambling has really been involved there. And you've been writing about this too, I believe.
That's right, yeah. I think this World Cup they're predicting will be the biggest ever for the bookies. £118 billion were spent in bets across the planet in the last World Cup. This World Cup's expected to smash that. Part of the reason for that is that lots of US states have legalised gambling since the last World Cup. So huge new markets have been opened up. And of course, the England-USA game is being played on Black Friday, the start of the Thanksgiving weekend. So perfect time for all those American soccer fans to get their bets in. Also, technological advances make it easier to place bets now on your phone and so on. So, yeah, it's looking like a good World Cup for the bookies. But FIFA, yeah, FIFA have never really had betting sponsors. They've got one this time, but announced very late, a Greek gambling operator called Betano, and they were announced as a third-tier sponsorship deal, in fact, after the tournament had started. But they're obviously nothing like as big or important to FIFA as the likes of Coca-Cola and Budweiser.
When you say third tier, is that literally what you mean, as in the you know, the significance of the amount,
yes,
these firms are spending?
Yes.
You know, the Coca-Cola and Budweiser will be first tier, and this is,
yeah,
you know, much more.
They're high up the scale, which was why it was a bit embarrassing for FIFA when the Qataris banned the sale of alcohol in stadiums, which wasn't great for their official beer sponsor, Budweiser.
Wasn't it always going to be banned in stadiums, but it was meant to be on sale outside stadiums? And then the government said, actually, it's not only not going to be available inside stadiums, but even outside, you're going to have to travel much further outside the stadium to very specifically designated areas.
No.
Is that right?
No. The way I understand it is you can now no longer buy beer or alcohol inside the stadium, which was the plan, but you can still buy it if you're in corporate hospitality, which sort of seems to me a good analogy for this World Cup. You know, you can't drink alcohol because that really offends our religious beliefs unless you're very, very rich, and then you can drink our official sponsor Budweiser's beer in a corporate hospitality box.
And the reason I said a couple of minutes ago that it kind of relates back to the UK is that obviously in the Premier League, there is way more gambling and there are way more betting firms on display, on shirts, on advertising boards.
Yes. Somebody counted in the opening weekend of this season, and there were logos for 15 different betting brands on display across 10 matches, which is quite amazing. They're on shirts, it's perimeter advertising, it's behind the players when they're giving their end of match interviews. It's everywhere. And then, of course, it's in the advertising breaks in between, you know, the halves. So, yeah, we're bombarded with betting advertising in this country. That's something that the UK government's supposedly looking into. they've been conducting a review into gambling legislation for a long time. It's finally rumoured to be coming to fruition, and that's basically because our gambling rules are designed for another era. They don't really take into account online gambling at all. So we need to sharpen all that up and address problem gambling. And there's talk of levies on the gambling operators to help prevent problem gambling. So we shall see what the government come up with.
I think it's been delayed about four times now, so yes. I think we might see what the government come up with.
We might. Perhaps.
Sarah Shannon there. Thanks to her, Jane McKenzie and Solomon Hughes. And thanks to you for listening to this episode of Page 94. That's all for this week. We will be back later in December with another edition. And of course, we'll be carrying on in the new year. Until then, if you would like a printed version of this podcast with many, many more stories than we are able to cover on this podcast, you can buy Private Eye magazine. All you need to do to get the magazine delivered to your home, much like this podcast is delivered to your provider of choice, is go to private-eye.co.uk and click on the big red button marked subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.